Business and Consumer Affairs, Wednesday, April 20th, House Bill 2871, 2847, 2793.
Years, and Jim Clean on my right, who is supervisor of the Public Service Division. Our objection to this bill, in addition to the fact that it would create additional work for my office in keeping records, and as you know, I have a fiscal note attached for additional personnel, it takes us out of the exemption under the public records law and requires us to disclose certain information on a complaint. And while you could argue that some of the information that they're asking to see may not be that extensive, at the same time, we feel that disclosing any of our public complaint files would be detrimental to this office and to the consumers. We get an awful lot of complaints from certain individuals out in the field that do not want their name to be shown in connection with the complaint. And there's a lot of information that we would never hear about if these people who are complaining to us knew that this information would be open to the public. I would like to have Mr. Eden tell you a little bit about some of the dangers that he sees in disclosing too much of our files.
You said people and the consumer himself, the insured
himself,
don't want to have their name revealed?
No. When we get a complaint, for example, Mr. Chairman, where an agent may complain about the trade practices or something that he know about another agent, they just don't like to have their name shown as the complaining party. And if we were going to disclose that, we wouldn't get a lot of complaints. We wouldn't hear about a lot of things that are going on in the marketplace that we should hear about.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Chairperson, my name is Ray Eden. As Commissioner Driscoll indicated, I've been an investigator with the Insurance Department for 14 years. My primary responsibilities lie in determining facts relative to alleged violations of the insurance code, which might lead to administrative sanctions, which are authorized under the code. In essence, I think, sir, that a great many of our cases, I would say possibly 15 to 20%, deal with a type of activity which in many cases is considered felonious and subject to criminal prosecution. To divulge the data and material that's gathered pursuant to the investigation, which would include statements from witnesses and other interested persons, would be detrimental to the furtherance of our investigative activities. And I might also point out that our investigation many times tends to clear the accused person just as often as it might tend to produce evidence which would support the alleged violation. In such a case where an active violation has been deeply investigated, the release of the information, I think, would be harmful to the person that was under investigation with respect to strictly the investigation cases that I have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, addition to that, it would place our office, I believe, in a very bad legal position in the event that the information got out and this person was cleared later, and they could probably file some lawsuits. The other problem in disclosing even the summary of the complaint and the description is that many, many people that are involved in these complaints, our health conditions are involved. And the doctors themselves are very reluctant to give their records to us when we're trying to settle a complaint that resolves a health condition. And many times that when we have to go to an insurance company to get some of this information, the only way that under the rights to privacy laws that are applied to insurers, that we must then be sure that this health record is kept confidential. So I really believe that there would be no useful purpose served by amending our present confidentiality laws, and I think that a good deal of harm could result.
Yeah, we do have a letter from the Attorney General.
You do
office. Any questions for Commissioner Driscoll?
Representative Hopper?
Commissioner, there's a whole section, Section 3 of the bill that exempts some records. Does this cover the bulk of your records?
No, that's Chapter 192. We have a specific statute in the insurance code that says that investigative files and complaint files are confidential. And the public records under section, on page 3 of the bill, part H, where they say public records are information, the disclosure of which is prohibited or restricted, otherwise made confidential, we were under that. That's 731.264, and this bill takes us out of that exemption.
One more, Mr. Chairman. Is there any part of the bill that you like?
Well, inasmuch as the bill itself takes the confidentiality away, I wouldn't say I'd like it.
Okay. Probably in agreement.
Thank you. Okay.
Ms. Driscoll, would there be a way, one of the concerns you had was the availability of the name of the complainant. Is there a process that you could use that, I agree that there should be some concern about confidentiality. Can you somehow keep that information from appearing on the complaint form? I'm not sure what your forms look like, but for those forms that would be available to the public, could you blacken out the name of the complainant, or could there be a two-part form where that portion would not show?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lindquist, we just don't have the time to do this type of thing. We do have a monthly complaint report, which tells the type of complaints that we have and the number. But our files themselves, we have an inquiry form that we send out to the consumer when they want to make a complaint, and their name and address and everything is on it. And it would take a great deal of time for someone to sit there and try and make copies that black out this information. I just don't see any practical way that could be done.
Representative Henlon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Driscoll, can you tell me what the process is if I've got a complaint against my insurance company for something that might fit into a violation of the code? I send a letter to you. Can you take that through the process, or the ultimate process, were I to appeal that as far as I could through the system? Where does it go first? What happens? What happens next if I want to pursue it? And so forth.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to handle that?
May I answer that? I'm Jim Clean. I'm Supervisor of Compliance for the Insurance Division. And the compliance officers work under my direction. A written request or a written inquiry received from the public is received within the office, and it's either in letter form from the individual or by a standard form that we use just to have the individual submit something to us. Upon receipt of the form, a number is assigned to it. It's given to a compliance officer who is especially in the area in which you're questioning or you have an inquiry concerning it. The general flow of work would be that we would acknowledge receipt of that information from you and advise you that we are checking into it, and we would then contact the parties involved, i.e. the agent, the insurance company, whoever might be involved with it, to determine their position on the question and their actions to see what it might be. Upon receipt of that, plus any other additional information we may ask from you or other parties involved, we would then review the information based upon our findings and its relationship to the insurance code to determine whether or not we have any jurisdiction or whether it was a violation of the code itself.
it's this part that becomes very difficult and very awkward for us, or awkward, it's sensitive, because much of the information that we receive is of a sensitive nature. The insurance companies are furnishing us data about the circumstances surrounding it, or even the individual complaining may provide us information that he would not want the public to look at. Also at the same time, we look at it if they feel there is a violation of the code, to look and see whether or not the investigation section needs to be involved with it. And at that point, it then really becomes sensitive because of the nature of the work they would have to do to gather their data. Once the information is reviewed, we attempt to determine an end to it by seeing if there has been a violation, if the company has been wrong, or if the individual has any recourse left. We cannot advise him as to his final report, but we can tell him whether or not there's been a violation of the code and possibly help him. We facilitate more than
possibly help him
by expediting the payment of a claim or explaining the circumstances surrounding the incident itself.
Do you have any legal power to do that?
We have the ability to have the carrier or the agent, of course, comply with the law, and if there has been a misunderstanding in regards to a claim payment, we can rectify that. If there has been a violation of the code, we can rectify that too.
By what means?
The insurance commissioner has the ability to fine or correct the matter through disciplinary action.
Administrative procedures where we would advise them of their rights and give them the right to a hearing, and Mr. Eden handles a lot of that for me.
Then if you found nothing and sent a letter out to me, the consumer, and the insurer saying, in our opinion, there's no violation, what is my remedy, if any, if I disagree with that finding?
Actually, that you as a consumer, we would first determine whether or not your concern is that the contract that you purchased from your insurance carrier paid the type of a claim that should be paid under your loss. First of all, we determine whether or not that claim is covered under the policy. And sometimes that we look further then and see whether you were the agent who sold you that product misrepresented that policy to the point where you thought you had coverage. So there are a number of things that get involved. If we have no reason to believe that there was a violation of the contract, terms of the contract, that it was not misrepresented, then we would tell you that we felt that there was, that the company, support the company's position. Then the only thing that you could do is you would hire an attorney and perhaps take legal action against the carrier. The punitive action that we take or penalties we levy, of course, there's no, that goes, if we do levy a fine, that goes into the general fund. That doesn't go back to the consumer.
If I might follow up, Mr. Chairman, the testimony earlier was that the names, well, that the facts would be disclosed. I'm reading the bill, and it says a descriptive summary of the complaint, including the resolution. Wouldn't it be fair to characterize this language as not requiring disclosure of sensitive facts, but merely requiring a summary, descriptive summary of the complaint?
It could be, Mr. Chairman, a representative panel. But what we would have to do is have a staff person take that information off of all the complaint files and make up some additional records, which would be, this is why we said if this would be done, we would need additional staffing to do it. The type of information that is easy for us to have is a type of complaint, whether it's a premium misquote or a lack of a failure to respond, poor service agents, or this type of thing, just a very simplified, whether claim denial, claim delay, we have that information in our computer. But to actually take a look at each of these and keep a record as to what the complaint was, and then later on, 2 or 3 months down the road, somebody else would have to add some more information, and it just takes an awful lot of time.
How many complaints do you get, let's say, in a year, and how many of those do you actually take action on against
an
insurer
year we
or
closed,
agent?
We had 1982, we closed 4,206 claims, and those are closed, whether open claims. We processed more than that or opened more claims. Of those inquiries, we had 55.7% of them were arguments or misunderstandings or disagreements over the amount of the claim. 14.6 were as to the premium handling. 11.3% were sales methods and practices. 6 were policyholder service. 5 underwriting, and all others were 7.4%. We average about 450 complaints each month that where files are actually opened. We have a great many other inquiries by telephone. We resolve
In excess of 50% commission.
Yeah, in excess of 50%, and I don't have the exact percentage of those claims are resolved in favor of the consumer.
I would say closer to 70.
Closer to 70, excuse me, about 2/3 to 70% of the claims are resolved in favor of the consumer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Am I right in understanding that other consumer complaint files are open to the public under the, and maybe you wouldn't know that, but under the Department of Justice?
Well, I don't believe Department of Justice records are open. There are quite a number of them, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Lindquist, I don't know. I know that the public records under ORS, there's chapter 177, 41, 40, 40, 57, 135, all of these that are listed are not public records. They're all exempt from the public records. And I'm sorry, I didn't look to see.
Well, okay, I guess my question is, you had stated before that some of the issues, you know, we're dealing with felonious type actions. And I guess in my mind, I'm not sure how your records are different from other records regarding consumer complaints. And are they? And if so, how?
Well, I can't answer that totally. I do know that a great many of the state agencies, they are not public records.
Okay.
But I really don't know how many other agencies. Nationally, for some reason or other, complaints on insurance have always been insurance department confidentiality because of the lawsuits and legal problems that are involved. We believe, frankly, that if there was easy accessibility, that we would be there would be a lot more court cases. You know, attorneys could. And I'm not saying they would, but attorneys could come in and say, you know, this looks pretty great.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hammond,
to follow up, I don't think I did get a direct answer to my question. You indicated 1982 there were 4,206 inquiries closed. My question was, of the inquiries that time period, what part of them actually involved a violation where you made a finding on the basis of the complaint against the company or the agent?
May Mr. Eden answer that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hammond, I did not bring the figures with me today. I can give you a very close estimation. In the investigation section, we currently have between 90 and 96 files in open status that we're working on at the current time. We've been short-staffed in the investigation section for over a year. Recently, we have been able to put another investigator on. With the short staff, our average, sanction, if you will, that's authorized by the insurance code will run probably 3 to 5 or 6 per month. Bear in mind, if you will, that we do follow the Administrative Procedures Act, and every file that goes to an administrative sanction must necessarily be handled in that formal fashion.
So between 36 and 60 per year is what your estimate is?
That would be a close estimate. would vary, Representative Hannon, with the staff available.
And if resources. I might just follow up, how does that relate to the 50 to 70% that are resolved in favor of the consumer? Are you saying those other complaints then, once you investigate the insurer, although not, or agent not sanctioned, may come up with a compromise with the consumer at your instigation or your inquiry?
They weren't necessarily, Mr. Chairman, a violation of the law. Most of the others are disagreement as to the amount of damages, for example, under an automobile, or whether or not there's coverage, but not a violation of the law per se.
Thank you.
Further questions from Representative Jones?
Joe, can you tell me what would be your response to a request to open information that does not give specifics of claims but rather categories, somewhat similar to your computer printout, only with somewhat additional detail than that provides? For example, how resolved, that kind of thing, or by company?
The reason, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, that we don't like to give out information per company, because unless you also give out the volume of business that company does in the state, you can run into some problems. The state of Arizona was sued because they gave out information that this company had a great many claims against them, and then when they found out that the company also wrote most of the business, and the number of complaints against the company in relation to the business they wrote was very small. If you have a company that just writes a very little bit of business and has one complaint, it can be much worse than someone who has 200 complaints but writes most of the business.
Sorry. Are you ready? Go ahead.
But we could give information like the number, you know, the number of complaints each month are available, and a category of complaint is available, without having creating additional work for us. Most anything else than what we have now would require additional reprogramming in our computer and additional expense.
Okay, the reason I'm asking this, I'm somewhat relating to my own experience. Public Utility Commissioner obviously does something similar to what you do with the insurance business. And I'm just interested because volumes and so forth, as I recall, are available. And obviously there's a great deal of difference as companies write more business or less business that relates to the claims. Yes. Is that a large increase in your workload to simply give information that would provide a percent?
Yes.
Of the insurance written in the state for that company?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, in view of the fact that we have almost 1,400 companies licensed to do business in the state, to keep all of these records would be time-consuming, and we really would require additional help. We feel that we've had so much difficulty just getting people in public service to handle complaints that we feel that's the important thing, is to have someone there to help the people with their problems, and keeping a lot of records that may or may not be useful, I think, is just a waste of my budget.
Representative Bennett.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Driscoll, you said Arizona was sued.
Yes.
Who won?
I shouldn't name the insurance company. The insurance company won.
Okay, and what was that based on?
It was based on information that was given out on the number of complaints that had been filed with the company, with the department against this particular company, but they didn't take it into consideration with the volume. And Arizona,
in other words, they said that, I'm sorry, just on that point, but X company had 12 complaints. They were sued over that kind of information.
No. They felt, the insurance company felt, that the publicity that the Arizona Insurance Department had given, the time that this company had all these complaints, was adverse to their business, And that's why, and they sued the department because they found it did damage to their business in the state.
Mr. Chairman, had the insurance commissioner then suggested this was a lot of complaints?
Apparently, the way that it had come out, it
in other words, it wasn't for providing information, it was for providing an analysis of information.
The
like.
Fact that it, I think what added also to that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bennett, was the fact that the Arizona Insurance Department at that time was taking all inquiries and saying, we've had so many complaints against this company. Well, we don't do that. We call all of our requests for help as inquiries. And then until that's resolved in the favor of the consumer, we don't lodge it as a complaint against the company.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, if I understand you, you're not suggesting in any way your agency would be sued over this bill?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Maybe not. Unless information was taken out of one of our complaint files that had alleged violations, and that information got out, and it turned out that these alleged violations were not violations, and it might do harm to that company if information got out and said, gee, this company is not paying their claims or whatever.
So you need an amendment that gives you some sort of immunity from suit for use of your statistical records, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, is that what... we certainly, if we provide judicial... You know, you can't sue the policeman who... or the court that alleges crime.
Well, believe it or not, I was served as a subpoena to contempt of court because someone didn't like the penalty that I had levied against an insurer, and that consumer wanted to have more say about how I ran my office, and I'm very grateful to say the judge said no.
Yeah.
But it still took up a lot of my time and a lot of money to have the AG go with me to say, hey, she's doing her job.
Mr. Chairman, one of my understandings is that as a member of the legislature, I can count on being sued. It just comes with the territory, so I assume they all get that. So I wondered on this question of record keeping, you mentioned that the Consumer Affairs Division does not provide open records. Did I understand you?
At the present time, by statute, our complaint files are confidential.
Right. But I thought you were talking about the Department of Justice as well having confidentiality around its consumer complaint files.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I would.
And how many people will you need to provide public information under this statute?
I put a fiscal impact of $39,980 for the first 2 years and $44,258 for the second biennium.
44.
Mm-hmm. That's just the increase of whatever my business manager said is the usual increase.
And how many people? How many people is this?
That's one administrative assistant.
Okay. And what would that person be doing in order to comply with a law that would, perhaps the one that that Representative Jones was outlining, where we get the name of the company and the type of complaint and disposition? What would be the cost, what would be their job in compiling that kind of information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bennett, what they would have to do on each of the 450 to 500 complaints that we get each month, they would have to keep records on those and then follow up to keep, well, I guess not quite the extent that Representative Jones asked about, but what this bill asks about, then ultimately include the resolution and so on. So they would have to keep track of those files up till the time they were resolved.
What's the database that your current record that you provide, where does that come from? You showed us
that is in our computer.
And what's in there along with it?
Well, we have our licensing. We have our agents' licensing records on our computer also. Each complaint?
Right.
May I respond to that, Mr. Chairman? The information that we have currently, if I can start back a little bit to explain how this arose. In 1976 is when the department first went on system with an automated program to record the inquiries as they came in and attempt to classify them as they were received or resolved within the department. The statute requires just that we record the items as they come in and be able to cross-reference them. And we attempted, in order to review the information as a red flag for us in working with companies or agents or really what's going on within the industry, to break that down into a finer category. And so this is really raw data going in, and it's based upon the public service officer who is reviewing that file and how he classifies the information when it is received. This also is true when you get down to the point of the resolution of the matter. The claim may be closed, and the company may have paid the claim as a result of our corresponding one. But that's also because possibly the insured hadn't gone back and furnished additional information to the company.
What I'm asking, I guess, Mr. Chairman, is off this form, I assume you have somebody inputting name, address, insurance company name, policy number, type.
That's correct. We do have.
So that is all part of the database that from which you withdrew that run that you showed us.
The initial information that you show right there at the front, the inquiry sheet, that there is input by a clerk within the office right now or by the public service officer who happens to be working with the client.
And you also have these categories, which will give you some broad generalizations, including others.
That is correct. And the individual normally will check those categories that you're referring to.
And then how is disposition marked on here?
On the reverse side.
Years I've called personally that office and had my constituents from Jackson County call, and maybe turned 20-25 people, and every one of those people got some results and got it what I thought in a fairly timely manner. And I guess it's one of the few places that I've worked with, and quite frankly, and state government, that I've had some people that really responded and seemed to care about my constituents. And I guess that's one of the reasons I have a problem with the bill.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Just a comment briefly is that, number one, you have to accept that fiscal analysis as one that reflects the real needs given this problem being posed in the bill.
Yeah.
And I, aside from what Brother Shiprack says, Representative Shiprack says, I would suspect that this bill has nothing to do with consumer complaints. It in fact just says we are going to open records. It does not deal with questions of whether or not they're effective in their agency. It just says we'd like to know. He's saying we'd like to know, are they being affected? Let us see the records. Believe me, as a newspaper man, that's one of the great frustrations.
Oh, that's the problem.
And then we know.
And you don't even want to pay to look at them. I just heard
certainly
that.
Certainly not, nor to copy them.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Brother Bob. Brother Bob. Pam Ferreira and Jen. Emily, could you come together?
Where do you find your brother?
I'll tell you. Find him.
Chairman Reichman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today to you on this bill. My name is Jan Amling of Albany. I'm speaking for Oregon Common Cause and also as a private person interested in the concerns of consumers. I'm a counselor at Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Lynn Benton Incorporated and spend considerable energy working with families, teaching them how to make cost-effective decisions. My educational background includes a Master of Science degree in Family Economics. The passage of House Bill 2847 would enhance the consumer's right to know, facilitate value comparisons among insurance companies and agents, and increase purchase satisfaction. Passage could also promote goodwill among the public, as they may see the Insurance Commission as a more useful agency if it appears to help consumers. ORS 731.008 states, as Mr. Shipwreck said, the Legislative Assembly declares that the insurance code is for the protection of the insurance buying public, unquote. Consumers need protection in the marketplace, not only in the way of safe goods and services, but also accurate and truthful information about those goods and services to facilitate intelligent selections. I believe the Insurance Commissioner's Office can open the complaints of the insurance buying public using existing resources. I'm sure the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee is aware of the Consumer's Bill of Rights and the rights and responsibilities of consumers. I would like to briefly restate some of these for you. The consumer's central civil right is the right to get his money's worth. The consumer has the right to sufficient facts to make informed choices and the right to register dissatisfaction and have complaints heard and weighed. Consumers have the responsibilities of making the best decision possible before purchase to reduce later dissatisfaction and responsibility to protest by complaint when dissatisfied. The steps in the decision-making process are problem recognition, search, alternative evaluation, choice, and outcome. It is in the search and alternative evaluation steps that access to prior complaints would be beneficial. In November 1982, a graduate student at Oregon State University conducted a survey of the 50 states to determine how other states handle insurance-related complaints. 35 usable questionnaires were returned. Of those, 21 states have open files and 14 have closed files. Of the 21 open states, 14 allow public inspection of either the original complaint or a copy of the complaint except medical information. This chart that you have that says states with open, closed files regarding consumer complaints, has two columns. One of them is the open states, the other is the closed states. I have looked at the questionnaires and taken the information off of them in terms of exactly what type of information they are making available to them, to the people that are inquiring. One of the questions on the questionnaire was, in actual consumer use, what percent of the complaints received are to file a complaint, to aid in consumer decision-making, or other? The responses, along with total complaints by state on the accompanying chart, indicate that from 0 to 85% of contacts are for aiding in consumer decision-making. The average of those responding was 25%. That is this other chart here. It lists the states again by open and closed states, lists the total number of complaints to get and breaks it down by percent how many of those items that were received were complaints and how many were things used in decision making, and the average again was 25%. Will this bill ask the insurance commissioner to do something that they are not equipped to do? I don't believe so. Chapter 731.288 of the Oregon Insurance Code states in part, quote, each written and signed complaint received by the division shall be recorded by the division, including the subsequent disposition thereof, and maintained for a period of not less than 7 years. The records of such complaints shall be indexed wherever applicable, both by the name of the insurer and by the name of the insurance agent involved, unquote. Apparently, the information this bill asked for is already being gathered. The present complaint form, which is the yellow form that you have, generates volumes of information, and I'm sure that we've already gone over that already today in terms of some of the information that is included on the back. The Insurance Commissioner's Office is currently maintaining a monthly complaint record, and that again you have. And what I'm envisioning, one of the spinoffs or one of the things that this bill will generate is this type of a form but broken down with the name of the insurance agent above with the numbers going across, or some form of a modification of this, whether it's complaints, a ratio of complaints to sales, total dollar sales, or however this would be projected. The Health Division is also required to make public certain complaints. Under ORS 441.703, and you have a copy of that, the Health Division of the Department of Human Resources shall maintain a listing of all long-term care facilities by name and address, and for each indicating complaint file number, category of complaint, whether staffing, food, patient care, or other, a brief description of the complaint, the Health Division's finding, action taken by the division, fees assessed if any, and fines paid if any. The division shall maintain a separate listing of all unsupported complaints. All of this information shall be noted in summary form on annual cover sheets for the file on a particular facility and shall contain no confidential information under ORS 441.670. Copies of the cover sheet shall be made available to the public at cost on request. I use this as an example to indicate that this bill is not asking for something that no other agency is having to do. There are two modifications to the present bill which I wish to discuss. The first is changing line 5 on page 1 to read, "The commissioner shall maintain for public inspection records of valid complaints." Okay, that would then eliminate this question of whether or not we're including total, whether all the inquiries that come in, whether we've got the justified and unjustified complaints, that we would only be addressing ourselves to the ones that are valid. The second possible change you may wish to consider would be to make the original copy of the complaint form available to the public. This may necessitate changing the current complaint form to include a statement such as, "I realize this complaint will become a public record," above the place where the person were to sign his name. This would making the original complaint available would eliminate the generality and vagueness of the characteristics on the complaint summary form that you have. In conclusion, I would like to share a statement President Lyndon Johnson made on signing the Freedom of Information Act in 1966, and I quote, "I have always believed that freedom of information is so vital that only national security, not the desire of public officials or private citizens, should determine when it must be restricted." Thank you for letting me speak.
Any questions, Lieutenant Johnson?
Yes, may I ask a few questions? First of all, can you tell me from the information you've provided to us how many of the open file states have laws that have the same information requirement that you have proposed for Oregon? Because I know there are varieties of things, even so much as the type of complaint and agent involved as being open. Can you tell me which of the open states or how many of those states have laws that are as open as the one you proposed?
I honestly cannot tell you that. We requested the states to send us copies of their statutes, and very few of them did, I think because a lot of them were so bulky. So I honestly cannot tell you or give you an interpretation of how their laws are written and what they are required to do.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, did you use a model of some kind to propose the legislation that you currently have?
Basically, the Legislative Council did was to take that section of the law which closes it and use that to generate this bill to open it.
Is that the way you requested it?
Pretty much so.
one more question. In the process of opening up and looking at this bill in relationship to what the commissioner has available today and what might be needed to be done to be changed to comply,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you give me a response as to your reaction to a bill that might change what you proposed but would still provide information by company with information that would be statistically valid without opening up the actual complaint file?
Where they would not actually see this form? Yes, I would be agreeable. At this point, I'm trying to get information for consumers so that they can make intelligent decisions. And if they have a problem with their company or with another company, a claim against them, and they're not having any success at resolution of that conflict, they can call and say, "I've got a complaint against this company. What is their track record? What kind of things, you know, do they normally settle out of court? Am I going to have to go to court?" At this point, I don't believe that that type of information is available.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Jan, I think Representative Jones asked a question, and I look at your states with open-closed filing and the kind of information. Doesn't that does refer to the kind of information that's available from those states in response to Representative Jones, as far as I can tell.
Right, but I would not want to stake my reputation on the fact that whoever filled out the questionnaire, and a lot of them were the commissioners or lawyers in their departments, but whether or not they are expressing the way their law is written, I can't tell you. I would assume that they are.
Thanks. Thank you for your excellent presentation.
Okay, thank you, Pat. Pam, you want to testify to it, Pam?
I just have one brief addition. For the record, my name is Pam Ferrara, Director of Oregon Common Cause. In another hearing on a different House bill on the same type of subject matter, House Bill 2519, the disclosure of confidentiality records of the Board of Medical Examiners, the objection came up that it would have, and I think Commissioner Driscoll also made this objection, it would have a chilling effect on the numbers of consumers who would be willing to complain. And I called, I had a conversation the other day with Ross Laburn, who is here today in the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office, and he gave me information on two Oregon court cases, and one of them I'd like to just tell you a little bit about today because it's very pertinent. It is Moore versus Westlawn Memorial Park. It's an Oregon court case, and the case arose out of a person complaining against a licensed funeral director. The person against whom the complaint was filed apparently got a lawyer to file a libel suit, and the suit was dismissed, and this is just, I provided a copy of the case for you, and I just wanted to read you one sentence out of that case. That a witness in a judicial proceeding is sworn has been stated as a reason for granting absolute privilege to statements of witnesses in judicial proceedings, obvious. However, the courts have extended the privilege to unsworn out-of-court statements because encouraging the sending of information to a licensing body is in the public interest. So I just thought you should be aware that there are court cases on record in the state of Oregon that uphold the fact that consumers who complain cannot be sued or anything like that.
Mr. Chair,
that's all I have to say.
I might also comment that for the benefit of Representative Shipwreck and comments that may be interpreted on concerning the insurance commissioner and Representative Harper's question, I think the theory of that case extends to the proceedings that we have here and the witnesses that testify before us as having absolute privilege to.
Yeah.
Pam, thank you.
Thank you.
We have this last one, maybe a short statement of Ross Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ross Laburn. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. For the past 7 years, I've served as legal counsel to the Consumer Protection Unit of the Department of Justice. I'm here today really at the invitation of the committee to be available for questions because we are one of the state agencies that are subject to the public records law. We don't have a specific exemption either under our own statute or under the public records law. I'm really, as I say, here to answer questions. I would like to make one brief comment, tell you a little bit about our procedures in terms of handling requests from the public. We have a yearly printout of the complaints that we've received, the written complaints that we've received. I think I testified earlier before this committee that that amounts to about, on average, about 6,000 written complaints per year. When someone would call our office and talk to the receptionist, if the caller says, "What can you tell me about company XYZ?" Our policy is that the receptionist would look at the printout for the last 2 years. Again, it's on an annual basis. Unfortunately, it's not on computer, it's on word processor. And so we don't have one particular listing with a complete complaint history since 1971 when the office was established. So she looks at the most recent 2 years and would state something to the effect that we have X number of contacts with respect to that particular business. If the caller then says, "I'd like to know something further about that company, can you tell me how those complaints were resolved or what was the nature of those complaints?" Our receptionist is instructed to answer that we can't provide that information over the phone, that our files are public records pursuant to the public records law, and if the caller wishes to come to our office, either in Portland or in Salem, we will make those files available for inspection. We have about 3 years ago, we made a change in that prior to that time, our complaints were logged in on a numerical system. It created real problems when someone wanted to come in and say, "Take a look at all the files against XYZ company." They weren't all together. Beginning about 3 years ago, we changed that system so they were now filed by the name of the respondent business. So if someone would come into our office and say, "I'd like to look at the files on XYZ company," the receptionist would then go to the filing system. There would be three or four complaints, however many there are, right together, and she would pull those files and make them available to the person for inspection. And with that, I'll just stand open for questions to the committee.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ms. Chairman. Mr. Labor, you handle it, you said 6,000 written complaints per year.
That's correct. Right? Yeah, estimate, yes.
What is the cost of handling those? What sort of a cost are you finding in dealing with that? I guess that's your whole agency's problem, though, isn't it? The whole
yes, I mean, you know, that's generally what we do. So you're talking about most of our budget.
Okay.
How much is that budget?
That runs just slightly over $1 million per biennium.
Okay. Do you get complaints against insurance companies?
We receive complaints under our sole jurisdiction is the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and there is an exemption in that statute for insurance matters. So all of those are immediately referred to the Insurance Commission.
Mr. Chairman, if that exemption were removed or the law changed for you to receive the 4,000 insurance inquiries. Apparently, we can't seem to figure out how many are complaints exactly, but there are some inquiries, and they're claiming 4,000 a year, I guess. Would there be a tremendous cost for you to handle them under your system? Yours apparently isn't computerized; it's handled on paper. Is that right?
I guess my question, Representative, what do you mean by handle? I mean, are you talking about doing the processing and investigating
no.
of those complaints?
No, just the filing and making them available to the public. We were told it would cost about $40,000 a biennium to allow the public to see their records.
$80,000,
however it adds up. And I just wondered if you would be able to do it less expensively. Perhaps we're going to the wrong agency for the people to handle the filing. Apparently the insurance commissioner's costs for filing are very expensive, and you may have a more efficient system because you've done it longer and been more in touch with the public on this thing.
I really don't think I can answer that question because, you know, you're talking about being able to pull that information back out, and a lot of that, of course, depends upon how you have it and what present form. As I indicated before, when we had it numerically, it was a problem.
Yeah.
One of the other things I think you have to consider is what are you pulling out? For instance, we're only telling people over the phone the number of complaints that we have. We're not engaged in any other discussion. If we were to, you know, go to the files and try to describe to somebody what was in the files, that would, of course, you know, cost more money to do that.
Oh, sure. I don't think that's what at least my reading of the bill, it doesn't speak to that. It just says these will be open, right, much like you handle yours, which is if you want to see them, come take a look, is the way I understand your description of how your office works.
That's basically
correct. If I want to look at your records, I have to come or somehow get a copy away from you to look at it myself.
May I ask one question? Are you finished?
Yeah.
If I come to your office and request to see a file on such and such a company complaints, and someone in that file, do you take their name off so the complaints are there but the names aren't?
No, we don't. I would say about 2/3 to 3/4 of the written complaints we receive come on our complaint form, standard complaint form, which we mailed out. Traditionally, the consumer would call us first to determine if we had jurisdiction. We would listen to their problem, say yes, and send out a complaint form. On our complaint form, we have a disclaimer which says something to the effect of, please be advised that this complaint will become part of the public record. So we do our best to put people on notice that if they are a complainant with our office, that information, including their name, is going to be part of the public record. I have had, occasionally, someone contact me who is irate because they find out after the fact that the complaint which they have filed with us is a public record because they did not get a complaint form. They sent us a letter, mm-hmm. and maybe they are familiar with the insurance division or the health division or whomever, another state agency that they've dealt with before. And from that process are under the impression that all records, all complaints filed with state agencies are protected.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you, Ross. We may have had, we don't have to schedule another hearing on House Bill, on this bill here to next week. I don't know when. I think next week. And we have to go to the other bill now. So we close the hearing on 2847, and we continue with House Bill 2793. Susan Nichols? Can you come together with...
Merle Campbell.
Make it one? Yeah.
Merle Campbell?
Yeah.
Tom Savage?
Fine.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 2793. My name is Sue Nichols, and I'm a student at Willamette University in Salem and a director for the Oregon Student Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization funded and directed by college and university students in Oregon. OSPIRG performs research and advocates on issues relating to consumer protection, the environment, governmental responsibility, and general social concern. Tom Savage of OSPIRG is also with me here today. And I would also like to introduce Merle Campbell of the Dieselgate organization, who is here with me today. Dieselgate is a consumer advocate group which seeks to get reimbursement from General Motors for consistently faulty automobiles. OSPIRG, in agreement with Merle Campbell of Dieselgate and the Oregon Automobile Dealer Association, would like to substitute for the printed bill Legislative Council's amendments dated April 20, 1983, which you have before you. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, we would like to speak to these amendments.
Can I ask a clarifying question? Would you tell me which amendments again?
Do you have the amendments before
I have several.
We have a bunch.
Okay, no.
This probably you refer to this.
That is my testimony.
That's your testimony. Uh-huh. Not the amendment you sent.
I think they're the ones 2793-4.
Is it dash 4?
Yes.
That's
the one.
Okay.
Okay. There's no question that defective automobiles constitute a consumer problem of the highest magnitude in this country today. The Federal Trade Commission recently reported that complaints about the purchase and repair of autos jumped from fifth to first place in 1981. This is reflected by many state and federal consumer groups, as well as the White House Office of Consumer Affairs, the National Lou Harris Poll, and the U.S. Council of Better Business Bureaus. This problem is enormous and destined to keep getting larger as more and more cars are sold under conditions that prevent the buyer from returning to the manufactured defective, unsafe autos. In Oregon alone, the lemon problem is substantial. The Oregon Department of Justice, Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Division reports that in the period from July 1, 1981 to June 1, 1983, the most recent year for which statistics are available, Oregonians filed 156 complaints concerning faulty vehicles. At today's prices, these complaints translate into over $500,000 that consumers of the state paid out for new motor vehicles that failed to satisfy the express warranty of mercantility. This $500,000 figure is only for 1 year, and comes before the vehicle begins its trips back to the dealer with all the expense, frustration, and lost time that does occur. But the problem is not just one of consumers throwing huge portions of their incomes away on a faulty, non-returnable product. Unlike the defective toaster or vacuum cleaner,
The defective auto is much more than an annoyance. It is a safety hazard and dangerous not only to its operator and passengers, but to everyone else on the road as well. Nor does this situation end with the car's first owner. The Lemon vehicle is truly a gift that never stops giving. Today's new Lemon is tomorrow's clunker, as these vehicles pass from owner to owner, multiplying in number every year, racking up repair bills and endangering more and more people. What can we do about these Lemon vehicles? Under present statutes, very little. Although Congress has passed several laws in the past decade aimed at assisting consumers plagued with defective cars, shoddy repair work, or other forms of automotive abuse, none has been at all effective in addressing the problems of Lemons. The Magnuson-Moss Act of 1975, for example, was expected to significantly reduce the problems consumers had in replacing defective cars, but it contains a number of serious loopholes. Specifically, the Act fails to define what constitutes a reasonable number of attempts to fix the car. What is worse, its key Lemon provision, under which a defective car may be returned, is avoided by all automakers except AMC by their refusal to give a full express warranty. As Michael Perchuk, former chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, puts it, manufacturers offer warranties to assure consumers that their cars are well designed and built. They promise to remedy defects that become apparent in the first part of the car's life. But too often, these assurances of quality are not met and consumers suffer the loss. Congress was aware of warranty performance and Magnuson-Moss Act offers two possible remedies. Unfortunately, in the case of autos, it now appears that these remedies are neither solving the problems nor lessening their severity. In conclusion, House Bill 2793 will provide the person who buys a defective automobile in Oregon with a badly needed tool for dealing successfully with the vehicle's manufacturer. The bill applies to all new motor vehicles, not just to those with a full warranty. It clearly defines a reasonable number of attempts to repair the vehicle, and it limits applicable defects to those which impair the use, value, or safety of the vehicle. This bill, unlike presently operating complaint panels, enables the car buyer to deal ultimately with the car's manufacturer. It is the manufacturer who must bear the responsibility for how a product is made and the cost of replacing it if necessary. It should be stressed that this Lemon Law, and those like it which have been passed in Connecticut, California, and Montana, is not an attack on the auto industry. It simply provides for the fact that, in a mechanized process such as automobile production, quality control measures notwithstanding, a few Lemon units are bound to be manufactured, and the consumer should be protected against having to foot the bill for these. Indeed, the bill contains some hidden benefits for the auto industry, as recognized by dealers in California after the bill was passed there. The Lemon Law will strengthen the position of the car buyer who is forced to play the game when a manufacturer or its agent refuse to acknowledge defects or requests endless opportunities to fix them. It will help to restore the confidence of American working public in our automobile industry and hopefully see the industry restored to its former state.